Fine Music Radio.
Hello and welcome to Book Choice on Fine Music Radio. I like to think of today's show as an early Christmas present. Because if you love books like we love books, this is going to be a real treat. We've got so many great reviews and a wonderful interview to share with you today. We've got a review of Sally Rooney's latest called Intermezzo. I haven't read it yet. In fact, I haven't read any Sally Rooney's yet, but I really have to. She's a massive, big hit of a bestseller. If you haven't heard of her name, I'd be quite surprised. After that, Shirley Gula is going to give us a second review of another big-hitting household name of an author with the latest Jodi Picoult. That's called By Any Other Name, and it's a riff on Shakespeare, and we'll get more into that. After that, Beryl joins us, and she's bringing us two book reviews by two authors named Kate. And she's found some other really intricate similarities between their two books, which are completely different books. So that's going to be a big Kate bumper festival. Then Rachel van der Pfeiffer, who is our YA reviewer and is now thankfully on school holidays so she can read a whole lot, is reviewing the latest by Mia Odern called A Thousand Eyes on You. I'm going to get more into that later. I'm a huge fan of Mia Odern's, and this is her first young adult novel. Then we've got Beverly Roos-Muller, who's here to chat about Peter Godwin's latest, which is called Exit Wounds. This is fascinating. I know Bev worked really hard on this review, and she struggled with it because she has some really personal feelings about it. So she's got a very intricate and very personal review about Peter Godwin's Exit Wounds. And then our nature reviewing slot, John Hanks is here, and he's here to talk about Freshwater Fishes of Southern Africa, which is a new book brought out by Strake Nature this year. Twangi Kalula read the latest by Bruce Whitfield, which is called The One Thing. I am desperate to read this book. Bruce Whitfield spoke to a whole lot of influential business people and big thinkers and thought leaders and asked them what the one thing is they would do to fix South Africa, and these are the solutions. Doesn't that sound good? And we play out our show as we always do every year. We have Zapiro on the show, and Philip interviews him and chats about his new annual that he brings out every year. And this year, the annual is called Have I Got Gnews? Have I Got News? Have I Got Gnews for You? And all of these incredible reviews and that one big smash hit interview are going to be bookended with some phenomenal music. Because this is Fine Music Radio, after all. Where would we be without the music? So you're very well placed. You're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick. Our whole show is sponsored by Exclusive Books, and it's pulled together by Mzu Makete, who is the man with the smooth voice and the great taste in music. He pulls our show together, he selects all our music, and he makes us sound really good. So let's get on with the show. First, that first track. This one's called Crazy, and it's by the Buscade Soweto String Quartet. Thank you. Welcome back. That was Crazy by the Buscade Soweto String Quartet. You're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick, the person who just loves books too much and can never stop talking about them, which means we always run out of time in the show, so let me get a move on. I've already told you all the things we'll be reviewing, so if you missed that, you're in for a treat. First up, we've got Shirley Guler, who's joining us, and she reviewed Intermezzo by Sally Rooney. As I mentioned, Sally Rooney, a big household name in literature. I haven't read any, ashamedly, and I think I'm going to correct it this summer. I think I'm going to read Intermezzo. I've seen a couple of reviews on this book, and they all say that it's possibly one of Sally Rooney's best, so it might be a good one for me to start with. Shirley Guler, do you think it's a good one for me to start with?
Gosh, I really envy people who can write paragraph after paragraph, often using the same words in different ways, then reading and rereading and proofreading them all over again. I had difficulty in reading over my school and university exams papers even once, so I stand in respectful obeisance to Sally Rooney and Intermezzo. The word intermezzo invokes music, a short connecting instrumental movement, a short piece for a solo instrument, or a light dramatic musical performance between the acts of a play. But for me, this is a main act. It's an act in three parts over a relatively short period, and is a collision in the softest sense of the word, of five lives. Two brothers a decade apart in age, two lovers a decade and more apart in age from their lovers, one older, one younger, and one former lover, now a good friend of the brothers, and perhaps about to become a good friend of the others. It's very tender. Even Rooney's erotic passages, especially between the older woman and the younger man, are very tender. Rooney's sentences are often incomplete. The subject is missing. Sometimes a subject and a verb are understood. Sometimes the paragraphs are very long, and there are no quotation marks to indicate direct speech. Still, there are few occasions when you need to reread to see if she's moved from Peter to Ivan or back again. If I had to sum up the relationships in one word, it would be complicated. Underscored by grief at the loss of a father and the guilt that follows, grief after an accident that changed two lives that did not need to change, grief experienced and grief handled very differently, anger, guilt about bad relationships no longer able to be fixed, irritation with the survivors, disappointment, lack of comprehension, or willingness to try to understand. Fights, not usually fist fights. The successful lawyer brother is struggling with life and love and needs pills to get through the night. The chess-playing brother, about 11 years younger at 22, is socially insecure with braces on his teeth, but gains the confidence to embrace a woman 14 years older. The main misfit is the carefree and careless student Naomi of the me generation, who kits the lawyer out with sex and pills in exchange for a safety net. Misfits all, yet all fit together, and it begs the question, what is normal, or what is uncomplicated? There are brittle parts, sardonic parts, weary parts, but all are compelling, and it's these complications that keep you glued to the book, page after 440 pages, hoping there will be a happy ending.
Thank you, Shirley, but don't go anywhere. You're up again, and this time you've taken on some big hitters for this December show, not only Sally Rooney, but now you're going to chat about the new Jodi Picoult, another big name, another household name in fiction. And this one, Jodi Picoult is very much an issue-driven author. She always grabs an issue. She does impeccable research. I would imagine she has a huge team of researchers who are helping her out with these books, because she brings them out quite regularly. And so she goes issue-driven. She picks the issue she wants to talk about. She researches it incredibly thoroughly. And then she brings out these page-turning novels. Lover or hater, she's a page-turner. So this one's called By Any Other Name. It's a riff on Shakespeare. It posits some very interesting hypotheses on who Shakespeare may or may not have been. So, Shirley Guler, is Shakespeare Shakespeare, or is Shakespeare by any other name?
Every time my eyes fall on the very old and most beloved collection of Shakespeare's plays on my bookshelf, I shudder. Thank you, Jodi Picoult, for disturbing my sleep with your impeccable research. For Jodi's latest novel, By Any Other Name, tells me convincingly and emphatically that it wasn't Shakespeare who wrote those plays. Questioning the identity of the author of Shakespeare's plays is not new. Bets have been placed on Oxford and Marlowe and even Mary Sidney for hundreds of years, but making such a definitive case for a courtesan called Emilia Bassano is, I believe, new. The author's note at the end tells you what is real and what is fantasy, but the case is so compelling that I would love to accept it all as fact, well, almost all. Even her wishful thinking that Emilia had a love affair with the Earl of Southampton is not as far-fetched as even Pico thought herself. After she'd completed the manuscript, she came across miniatures of Emilia and an unknown man, which it seems was Southampton. But it's somewhat satisfying to know Emilia had some light relief when her world came crashing down. First of all, why could Shakespeare have been a fraud? As a busy actor and producer, where did he find the time to write nearly 40 plays? How did he have so much knowledge about so many things when his life was actually quite limited? He never played an instrument, yet music filters through so many of his plays. He never traveled. So how could he write about the court in Denmark or the Italian countryside with so much authority? He wrote about the court and the army, but not from experience. Okay, end of that story. So why a woman? Consider this. Shakespeare didn't educate his daughters. They both signed documents with an X, yet he has written about some of the strongest literary female characters in history. Cleopatra, Lady Macbeth, Portia, etc. How did he have this insight? Women were such secondary characters in those days that few men would have championed them, let alone dressed them as men to make idiots of other men. There's more. Emilia was of Italian heritage, and her relatives were the court musicians. She most likely traveled to Denmark when she was very young. She certainly knew enough about Italy to write convincingly about it, and Jodie even makes a case for her meeting Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, and points out that Ophelia could have been named for her dead baby girl. Remember Shylock? It was Emilia who had to hide her Jewish origins and practice her faith in secret, so she had the knowledge. Did he? Unlikely. But that's history. This book is more than that. It's a story of two strong women who lived, loved, and worked 400 years apart. The parallels between Emilia and modern-day American playwright Melina Green are also strong, stark, clearly drawn, and in total sync. It is a man's world throughout this novel. Then Melina becomes Mel, and all hell breaks loose. While Emilia, at the age of 10, is forced to be a partner to a really decent older married man who has to marry her off once she is pregnant to save his wife's face, Melina is forced to take action of her own if she wants to see her work published and even achieve revenge. Melina is also a very good writer, recovering from a slap in the face dealt out by a critic some years before because he didn't think much of women. I resented it when Jodie left Emilia to concentrate on Mel. And then, after a sort of coda in the middle, I began to resent it when she left Melina for Emilia. It's that gripping, I promise you. But it was nice to know there's a happy ever after for one and a well-lived productive life for the other. If anything jarred, it was that Pico credited Emilia's wife-beating husband with thoughts and words I believe to be way above his station. But that is a minor carp. The terrible thing is we will never truly know if Shakespeare really was Shakespeare, and if not, if it was Emilia. I like to think it was.
Wow, I'm riveted by that. Would a rose by any other name smell as sweet? Would a book by any other Shakespeare read as well? Remains to be seen. This is a Jodie Picoult I definitely want to read. I always feel like with these books that I really should brush up on my Shakespeare before I go into them, but I don't think I'm going to have time. That would take a really long time. Thank you, Shirley. We're going to go into a track now. This is Where Were You by the Soweto String Quartet. I guess we could ask the same of Shakespeare. Where were you? Were you making plays and stealing other people's work, or were you just a massive overachiever and doing it all? I wonder if we'll ever know. Into the music. Thank you. That was Where Were You by the Soweto String Quartet, and you're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your book-loving host, Paige Nick. And our show is sponsored by Exclusive Books. Before we go on, I actually want to take a moment to shout out to Exclusive Books. I want to shout out to Batya Bricker, who is the head of books and brands at Exclusive Books. Also to Helen Holyoke, who manages the PR for Exclusive Books. And I know there's a whole team, a bigger team behind them all. You guys support us so much. You send us books, you look after us, you make yourselves available to be on our show, and you sponsor this show, which is a huge deal. Without you, we wouldn't be able to do this thing. We get to have an hour-long radio show talking just about books. I believe it might be the only radio show that's an hour long left in South Africa. So we really value this time, and we really value your partnership, and we very much value your sponsorship. Listener, if the book you seek does truly exist, you will find it at an Exclusive Books. Please support them because they support us. And we would kind of be lost without them. Back to the reviews. We've got Beryl Eichenberger up now. And Beryl did a really interesting thing. She's found two novels by two authors named Kate. And she's reviewed them both, and she's found some really unique similarities between them, which is fascinating because these are completely unique books. They're not similar to each other at all. But besides being written by authors named Kate Furnival and Kate Moss, they're very similar. Welcome to the show, Beryl Eichenberger and the Two Kates.
Two novels, two Kates, Furnival and Moss, two protagonists with the same name, Gilles, and a similar distinguishing feature. A Strange Coincidence in The Crash by Kate Furnival and The Map of Bones by Kate Moss, set centuries apart, but the stories could not be more different. Both these novelists are powerful and popular writers, and if I was to recommend holiday reading, then these two are on my list. Vital, vivid, and easy reads, they're stories of value that will touch you. Kate Furnival offers a steam train of a ride in The Crash. What if something happened that allowed you to conveniently swap identities? What if those identities were inextricably, unknowingly linked? What if priceless Egyptian artifacts were being stolen from their source and all fingers pointed to a highly esteemed minister? Furnival has created a complex and yet thoroughly believable network of threads that twist and bend and until the story reaches its destination. Paris, 1933. 2 days before Christmas, dark and snowy, vivid scene setting, and the tension begins. Gilles Malraux, a streetwise, strong but essentially honourable man, rather averse to the police for reasons we shall find out, recognisable for the white streak in his hair, boards the express train to Strasbourg. He is following a man with an obviously heavy suitcase, and as they settle into their carriage, Gilles is acutely aware of fellow passengers, or enemies. But when the express crashes into a local train, whatever plans made are literally turned upside down. While Gilles escapes the wreck severely injured, he stops to help a man thrown clear but in worse distress. The mayhem allows him to swap identity papers. But when he is rescued, taken to the home of a local woman, has he landed himself even deeper in a dark world? Back in Paris, Gilles' sister Camille is waiting for his Christmas visit. Their closeness and care for each other is tangible, even though Gilles is often away, bound by their unconventional, abusive upbringing, by their late prostitute mother. They are a resourceful pair. Camille, determined to rise above her lowly beginnings in the back streets of Montparnasse, well on her way with her solid French civil service job. The hospital call reveals a stranger with her brother's papers, and the mystery has to be unravelled, a task she takes on with courage and cunning. Furnival plots her novels brilliantly, each telling a unique story. Her imagination allows us to ride a magic carpet of clever and fluid writing. Unpredictable, The Crash will take you along on the fast track where chaos reigns. The Map of Bones by Kate Moss is the fourth and final novel in the Joubert Family Chronicles. The series inspired when Moss was a guest at the French Hook Literary Festival some years ago. What a powerful story, one that is told with obvious affection for the Cape, but holding nothing back of the cruelty and hardships of the 17th century. I've not read the other three books, but was captivated by this one. Prequels already on my to-be-read list. We're all aware of the heritage of the Franschhoek area, the Huguenots who founded it. French influence abounds to this day and is lovingly nurtured by locals. For me, this book filled in some of the gaps of the how, why, and where of these settlers and the effect their impact still enjoys today. Moss elegantly takes us from war-torn France in 1688 as Huguenot Suzanne Joubert escapes with her grandmother to the fledgling Cape Colony. Persecuted, terrified refugees landed in the Cape with a promise of land, but it was the courageous women who were the key to survival, and the novel highlights this. Suzanne's quest is different. She seeks the answers to her cousin Louise's disappearance. A notorious she-captain and pirate commander, she sailed for the Cape some 60 years before with her friend Gilles. Tracked by the evil Philippe, with a white streak in his hair, Louise's diaries and letters tell an unfinished story, which Suzanne is determined to complete. The answers lie in the Olifant's Hook area, now Franschhoek. But this is a treacherous journey that a woman cannot take alone. Guides are essential, and Moss shows the skills of the indigenous people as Suzanne finds a way. Superstitions, greed, and truth collide as she uncovers deeply hidden secrets. 1862, some 180 years later, and another intrepid woman of the Joubert family, Isabelle Lepard, makes the same journey, her mission, to record her female ancestors' history in a book and open a family archive. To close a circle as she brings the stories of the women of her family together, a legacy for the future. Her discoveries, the unraveling of a painful past and a dangerous present, show the fortitude of early adventurers and the perils they faced. This is a fully immersive peek back into the beginnings of one of our most loved areas of the Cape. Told with surety and fluidity, it is totally engaging as you sail the high seas with Louise, struggle with the patriarchy and entitlement of officials, walk the cobbled streets of a colony in its infancy, read of the hardships and the heroines. An absolutely wonderful story. Intricate detail shows the depth of research. However, it highlights the plight of all refugees, then and now, the search for a safer life, and of those who laid the foundations, built on the bones of others, for future generations. Respect for those that laid the path must be remembered, and Moss's words capture that. Kate Furnival, The Crash, published by Hodder and Stoughton. Kate Moss, The Map of Bones, published by Pan Macmillan.
Thank you so much, Beryl. That was really, really fantastic. I was at one of the Franschhoek Literary Festivals that Kate Moss was at many years ago, over a decade ago. And it's so mind-blowing to me to think that she came to that festival, at the festival we were all at. She saw the mountains. She got immersed in the culture and the feeling of the Franschhoek Valley. She went away and she's written all these books about our history. And I just find that incredibly inspiring and incredibly moving as well, that she was just overtaken. Imagine how much passion you have to feel for something to do this amount of research and bring out this many books about a subject. And she's not even from here, although she seems to have very deep roots with South Africa and particularly with Franschhoek. So this has been a big seller. The Map of Bones has been a big seller of the season. I've seen it in all the bookshop windows. I've also read a few reviews. And it sounds like a really, really good, deep, thick read. And of course, Kate Furnival never disappoints. Thank you, Beryl. You also never disappoint. Thank you for all your work this year, working with us, reviewing and interviewing, and for being so immersed in the literary landscape of South Africa. We really do appreciate all your hard work. And now over to Rachel van der Pfeffer. Rachel is our resident young adult reviewer. She's still in high school. She's on school holidays now, so as I said, she can read and read and read. And this week in our show, she's reviewing a book by Mia Ardern called A Thousand Eyes on You, which is by LARPA Books. So I read Mia Ardern's debut novel, which came out a couple of years ago. It's called Mermaid Fillet. It is so unique and so South African. I highly recommend it. I was just reading now one of the reviews of it, call it blisteringly fresh and distinctively South African, and that it really is. It's very noir. It's a noir crime novel, so of course it is. And it's a very young novel, so I'm not surprised she's moved more into YA. It's very young and hip and fashionable. I was just reminding myself about what it's about, and this is the blurb for Mermaid Fillet, which is Mia Ardern's first novel. The blurb is, the only human ever born wearing Jordans, you know, Jordan shoes, Jordan's sneakers, receives a DM on Twitter after a gang-related hit, and so the madness begins. Mermaid Fillet is an explosively fun crime noir set in the northern suburbs of Cape Town. It combines gritty violence, incisive humor, and magic realism to make a blisteringly fresh and distinctively South African novel. I concur. It is all of these things. A lot of it is in half English, half Afrikaans, slangy jargon. It's very young and very fresh. Ardern. So that's what I know about Mia Ardern historically. And now she's brought out A Thousand Eyes on You. I think that Mia Ardern is an author to watch. I think she's got a big future. If you have a younger person in your life, or if you like to read younger person's fiction, if you feel quite hip and with it, I recommend Mia Ardern's writing to you. I think she's an exceptionally talented writer and wordsmith. And what I really love about her is how she uses the South Africanisms that we have in our different languages. And she makes a whole new language of her own that you can absolutely understand. And so, Rachel van der Pfeiffer, tell us all about Mia Ardern's latest YA novel called A Thousand Eyes on You.
A Thousand Eyes on You is local author Mia Ardern's debut YA novel. Kayla is still recovering from the death of her ma 3 years earlier. Finally feeling ready, she opens a book of spells Ma left for her and soon starts to notice signs of magic everywhere, other realms creeping into ours and eyes staring from all directions. Tyler is struggling with guilt over his younger brother's death, blaming himself for the accident years ago. Kayla and Tyler's lives soon become inextricably entwined and they are thrown headlong into a world of magic and ancient deities. A Thousand Eyes on You is the first book by South African author I've reviewed, so I was really looking forward to reading it, and it did not disappoint. It was filled with South African slang, Afrikaans dialogue, and the story is inspired by indigenous mythology, all of which is a refreshing change from the Eurocentric novels I read a lot of recently. It was almost surreal to read a book set in such a familiar setting. I laughed out loud when the main characters had a life orientation class. The narrative uses dual point of view, a technique which has had a surge of popularity in recent years. While this sometimes clashes the narrative, it works really well in this novel and furthered the story. This book is wonderfully written, but it is unfortunate that it was poorly proofread and that let it down slightly. But don't let that stop you from checking it out. A Thousand Eyes on You is written by Mia Ardern and published by LARPA Publishers.
Welcome back. That was Tea for Two by Crystal Burkholz, and you're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio. This is our last show of the year, if you can believe that, and it's our pre-Christmas show. It's our little early Christmas gift to you. And my name is Paige Nick, and the show, as I mentioned, is sponsored by our friends at Exclusive Books. We still have 3 reviews and 1 big interview coming up, so stick around. We're going to go now into Beverly Ruiz Miller's review of Peter Godwin's latest, which is called Exit Wounds. Bev and I have been talking about this review for a long time. She asked to review it when she saw it was coming out, so we set it aside for her. And then she read it, and I reached out to her, said, are you ready for a review for last month's show? And she said, no, I'm not ready yet. And then we chatted about it again, and she said, I've put so much thought into this. I really read it very deeply. This is deeply personal to Beverly, this book, and you'll hear why when she reviews the book. So you can really know how considered this review has been of Peter Godwin's latest novel called Exit Wounds. Beverly Rosemuller is an author in her own right, and before she gets on to Peter Godwin's book, I actually want to tell you about her latest book, which is called Hunting the Seven, How the Guguletu Seven Assassins Were Exposed. This has been a breakthrough title that was released in South Africa this year. It's about how in 1986, seven young men were shot and killed by police in Guguletu in Cape Town. The nation was told they were a terrorist MK cell, which was plotting an attack on a police unit. An inquest followed. Then there was a dramatic trial in 1987, another inquest in 1989. And finally, the fact that Eugene de Kock's Flock Pass unit plotted and drove the operation was revealed eventually at the Truth and Reconciliation, 10 years after the murders. The whole thing has been very shrouded in mystery. Beverly Rosemuller, who has a long history of being a journalist in South Africa, took to a pen to tell the story of the Guguletu Seven and hunt for the truth of their deaths. It's taken a decade and two journalists, lots of lawyers, anti-apartheid activists, and TRC investigators to get to the bottom of these killings. And Bev has very carefully sifted, comb-toothed through the evidence and original interviews with those involved to reveal what actually went down. So this has been a massive release this year. I know that Beverly Rosemuller has received a lot of heat for this book, but it's also been very lauded for bringing us the truth. So I've got a lot that I want to say about Bev. I want to thank her for all her reviews that she's done for us this year. Over and above the fact that she's been writing these very hectic books that have required a massive amount of work. So Beverly, your commitment to literature and to journalism and to bringing us the truth is so important and it's very valuable to all of us. Thank you for that work, and thank you for giving us the gift of being on this show. You are our Christmas gift. And now you give us even more of a gift because you're going to tell us about Peter Godwin's Exit Wounds.
Born in Zimbabwe and later a war correspondent, Peter Godwin's Exit Wounds is a beautifully written and painful account of his life now lived on other continents. In his 60s, he is witnessing the last days of his extraordinary difficult mother and of his own marriage as well, as the existential loss of whatever home means to anyone who can no longer live there. His earlier books, When the Crocodile Eats the Sun and Makiwa, were extraordinary, charting the disintegration of lives in Zimbabwe and his own deep loss of his elder sister Jane, who had been killed there. At first I found it quite difficult to get into this book. His losses, his reporting of violence in townships and countryside and moors, felt a bit too close to the bone for me, who had witnessed and experienced similar acts of force. And yet Africa, our mother continent, remains beloved to all its children. To feel unable to live in the only place we know as home is an excruciating exile, never fully overcome, a longing, a yearning for the familiarities of childhood, sights and sounds and smells that are part of us forever. Godwin's mother, Dr. Helen Godwin, a tough-as-nails medical doctor, now lies dying in England, where her younger daughter, Georgina, lives. Helen had seldom offered comfort or praise to her son, Peter. She remains a potent force with a new posh accent that earns her the title of Her Grace. Godwin later discovered it was closer to her own childhood accent, returning like a swallow to her as she lay dying. Later he discovers she had been in the first intake of women at St. Bart's Hospital, a pioneer there and in Zimbabwe, where she worked as a healer throughout the warfare. Meanwhile in America, where he now lives with his wife and children, Godwin's marriage is suddenly ending. His smart, talented journalist wife has flourished there, while Godwin covered wars and wrote books and then tended their children. Now, she tells him, she wants to live alone in a white room with a white ceiling, but without a husband. They sell the family holiday home, and so comes another exit for Godwin, a loss he doesn't want, yet over which he has no control. His wounds are palpable. a man who needs to please woman but feels he has not done so, that his mother had always been disappointed in him, though she gives him a slim deathbed compliment that is of some comfort. Godwin suffers like all exiles of existential losses, the homeland that is no longer accessible, his past being literally another country. An old Irish joke he recalls is of the farmer who, on being asked to give directions, replies, "You've started from the wrong place." His wrong place, his African past, feels like an old wound throbbing in the bones, knowing that forever after the leaving of it, he will bear the scars of an exile. Exit Wounds also reveals his scholarly upbringing, evident in the classical allusions, the deconstruction of words and phrases. It is not light holiday reading, but for quiet contemplative thought, for those able to travel an empathetic journey with a wounded writer for whom home, home, will likely be forever a lost world. Highly recommended.
Thank you so much, Bev. John Hanks is up next for a nature segment. He's talking about Freshwater Fishes of South Africa, which is a complete guide by Paul H. Skelton. That was brought out this year by Strake Nature, which is an imprint of Penguin Random House. We do love our nature segment. John, thank you for bringing us your green fingers, your green ideas, and your green reviews. We love hearing about the bird books, the animal books, the Karoo books, the Kirstenbosch books. You brought us so much of the outside world you brought into our radio station and into our minds and into our homes. So thank you for reviewing these books for us. And let's hear about Freshwater Fishes of Southern Africa.
I wonder how many of our listeners know that fishes are the most numerous and diverse group of vertebrates on the planet, and that in Southern Africa we have no less than 336 species of freshwater fishes, including a selection of prominent estuarine and marine species also found in the region's freshwaters. For anyone wanting the best possible definitive guide, superbly illustrated, to an often overlooked component of our biodiversity, you must get yourself a copy of Paul Skelton's third and extensively revised edition of the Complete Guide to the Freshwater Fishes of Southern Africa, a compendium first published in 1993. The author of all three editions is the distinguished academic Professor Paul Skelton, the Emeritus Professor of Ichthyology at Rhodes University, who's focused on freshwater fishes for all of his professional life. I've no doubt that this latest edition will have enormous appeal to both anglers and academics alike. The quality of the species accounts is in a class of its own, with each species having a distribution map, details of measurements and text highlighting key identification features, together with notes on biology, ecology and conservation status, all supported by superb photographs and illustrations. The first quarter of the book has a comprehensive introduction to freshwater ichthyology in Southern Africa, with readable and informative accounts of the early history of fish collection in the region, together with fundamentals of fish anatomy, their habitats, and human-fish interactions. There is a section on recreational fishing, or angling, noting that this is the largest participatory sport in Southern Africa, relying heavily on a few introduced alien species, such as the brown trout, which was successfully imported to Natal from Scotland in 1890. Private trout fishing is now an established industry in Southern Africa, supplying fish both for sport fishing and for the table. The introduction also has a detailed overview of parts of fish anatomy, which you can easily take for granted, namely fish scales, noting that the bony scales of growing fish increase in size throughout the addition of concentric outer layers, and the pattern of these growth rings are used to determine the age of fish in the same way that foresters determine the age and history of a tree from the rings on its trunk. You might be surprised to read that fish have a highly refined sense of smell. Using this well-developed sense, not only to detect food items in the water, but also to locate familiar places in their environment, a fascinating ability demonstrated by certain migratory species. The salmon, for example, are known to home accurately to the stream of their birth using smell, with the chemistry of the home stream being imprinted on the hatchling fish before it leaves on its life journey. Fish can also communicate with each other by means of alarm substances, which rapidly alert other individuals to the danger they are facing. There are lots more items of real interest like this in these introductory pages. I have no hesitation in giving this excellent and highly informative guide, superbly illustrated throughout, my strongest possible recommendation. The title again, Freshwater Fishes of Southern Africa, A Complete Guide. The author is Paul Skelton. It's just been published by Straight Nature, an imprint of Penguin Random House, and you can get a copy for 470 Rand.
Thank you, John. So we're heading towards the end of our show. We've got one more review and then we've got a huge interview, and that'll be us for the year. Our most wonderful Twanji Kalula is here next, and this is a book Twanji wanted to review for a long time as well. Like Bev put her hand up for the Peter Godwin, Twanji put his hand up the second he saw Bruce Whitfield was out. And Bruce Whitfield's new one is called The One Thing. It says that it's about small ideas and big outcomes and a brighter future for South Africa, which we could certainly use going into a new year. I have no doubt Twanji will tell us all about Bruce Whitfield, but I can add to that by saying that he's a broadcaster, he's an author, he's a public speaker, and he's consistently looking for opportunities in our times of uncertainty to make change and to bring positive outcomes. So in this book, he draws on his access to a network of business leaders, founders, and deep thinkers to bring us each of their one thing that they suggest that we can do to make this a brighter South Africa.
In a world with many complex problems, there's something to be said for simplicity. Life has become complicated and there is power in doing just one thing at a time, which is in effect the premise of Bruce Whitfield's latest book, The One Thing. The veteran journalist and radio broadcaster has spent decades at the forefront of South Africa's problems, unpacking what they mean for the markets and the economy, and he is well aware that it'll take more than goodwill and good fortune to turn things around. But he also knows that there are incredibly smart, creative, and talented people who have big ideas and the skill sets required to solve the problems we face. South Africa has had some big wins this year. For one thing, load shedding certainly feels like a thing of the past. We have a government of national unity that has been well received by the markets, and the pandemic finally feels like it has passed. But that doesn't take away from the ongoing issues like unsustainable unemployment levels, poor quality education, and very slow economic growth. In this book, Bruce Whitfield opens up his enviable Rolodex to find out what some of South Africa's most acclaimed and respected thought leaders would do if they had the opportunity to do just one thing that would move the needle on a major challenge facing our society. And the result is a surprisingly uplifting collection of short, punchy, well-crafted essays. Although they complement each other, each contribution stands alone, offering interesting perspectives and varied viewpoints. From business leaders and former sports stars to academics and political thinkers, the book takes you on a tour through the minds and the lived experiences of these interesting South Africans who have diverse range of backgrounds. So there are well over 50 contributors, and they're sharing ideas on everything from education and childhood development to healthcare and housing. By way of example, there's Adrian Gore, who has been instrumental in building and growing Discovery into the business that it is today. And he explains what he would do to get South Africa's economy going. One of my favorite agricultural economists, Wandile Sihlobo, writes about what meaningful transformation could mean for our future. And he grapples with the challenges of land and food security. Business titan Bonang Mahale talks about the big elephant in the room, corruption. How do we root it out? How do we divert more of our money to the places where we want it to go? And then, of course, it wouldn't be a Bruce Whitfield project without Warren Ingram, who prints a piece on the power of private money. Of course, this is not the first book of its kind. We all know that thought leaders get together to collaborate like this all the time. But the magic here is that Bruce is a master when it comes to curating conversations and getting down to what really matters on a diverse range of issues. And I think that skill pulls through in this collection. It has his trademark energetic solution-oriented approach sprinkled all over it. And throughout it all, he reminds us that challenges are like kindling for new opportunities. So if you're looking to feel a little bit more upbeat about the country's possibilities and want to consider new approaches to dealing with the problems that we face as we enter a new year, I highly recommend this one. The One Thing by Bruce Whitfield was published by Pan Macmillan and retails for 330 Rand.
That was Moderato from Sonata in G by Tatiana Thale and Dimitri. You're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick. This is our very last show of the year. I get a little bit nostalgic, but it's also our Christmas gift. So I feel all warm and fuzzy. I also feel very warm and fuzzy about all the books that we've covered in today's show. Each one of them is exceptional in their own right. I can recommend them. Our reviewers can recommend them. And you've heard a little bit more about them, so you can decide for yourself what sounds like it's for you. We're going to end off the show, as we always do at the end of the year, with our annual Zapiro interview. Philip Todras is here. He chats to Zapiro every year, and he tells us all about the inspiration and the news and the politics and the laughs behind all the columns he's brought out this year, how he selected them into this particular annual, and gives us a little bit of insight into how he pulled that together. It's always super interesting. Welcome to the show, Philip Todras and Zapiro, our national treasure.
Zapiro, have I got news for you, spelled G-N-U-S, and cartoons from the Daily Maverick. And in fact, this is the 29th edition.
It is, yeah.
That's not bad. You'll be 30 next year. But you know, our constant theme between the two of us, that being Zapiro is no joke. That there are very many things that you're telling us about, and this has been quite some year. So would you like to tell us about some of the important themes to you?
Well, I mean, the title and cover usually are a very central theme in the country and in something that I've identified as being part of the zeitgeist. Certainly, this election was very, very difficult and fraught, and it felt important, and we didn't know what was going to happen. And in fact, there were some unpredictable things. And one thing that came out of it was this new. It's a glorified coalition. It's not really a new. But let's call it a new because that's what Cyril and co. want to call it. The EFF and the MK don't like the fact that it's called a new because they're not part of it. And in fact, they're right. It isn't actually a government of national unity. In fact, MK actually took the SABC to court for calling it a government of national unity. And I've got a cartoon in the book about that. So this new character I just pulled out of my 1994 cartoons that I did when Nelson Mandela had a real government of national unity. And this little character now becomes part of a whole lot of what happened in this book. But of course, there's been the American elections, massive Trump and Kamala Harris. I mean, there's an absolute travesty that they have voted this criminal back in, a criminal and rapist and whatever hell else he is.
Then psychopath?
Psychopath, yes, sure, sociopath, whatever. And across another part of the world, what's been massive is what happened after October 7th, the Hamas attack, and then ridiculous Israeli reaction which of course is in contextualized by, you know, 75 years of oppression and persecution and occupation. So I get criticized for all the kinds of cartoons that I do on whatever subject, but usually by different people.
Well, at least you're out there and people are noticing, and that's the point about satire. Yeah. You're taking serious issues, but you're finding an angle that makes people rethink.
Look, it would be too much to say it makes people rethink. If there's a small proportion in the sort of gray area on any particular issue who I can get to kind of slightly reset, see things in a slightly different way, that would be something in itself. Because you can't go and think you're going to change somebody's entire worldview with one cartoon. Over years and years and years, you could let someone see a sort of a general pattern of thinking which may influence them in some way or another.
But again, what intrigues me always is how this is being used to tell history. Because your work is being used, someone like Mike von Fraun can talk about that, and also the schools being able to use it as a way of, if you understand the story, you might get the joke.
It's one of the best things for me, and I say it every time anyone asks me about that. It's probably one of the strongest connections I have with young people, now being kind of mid-60s myself and having grown children. But I have, you know, kids from 8 or 9 who are starting to really get, even younger sometimes, but getting into the cartoons, and then the sort of then the teenagers, and then people who are studying at varsity and using it, and then people who tell me that they were introduced to politics and history and all sorts of things in some way through the cartoons. You know, people all the way up to, you know, maybe the age 40 or something. It's just quite incredible for me, that idea of it being a learning resource and history and something talking about what's going on all the time. It's got all that kind of, there's a sort of reciprocity in how it affects society.
Well, another interpretation for me of GNUS is the good news about you and Showerhead this year.
Yeah, that's been quite an amazing thing.
But the Showerhead doesn't only relate to you know who, it relates to you.
Yeah, well, the director, Craig Tanner, who's a South African lawyer who moved to Sydney in 2008, he contacted me. He says it took a long time to get to me. I'm a bit embarrassed about that. I mean, I said, oh, it all started in 2016. He was standing next to me in a Q&A, and he said, it started a bit earlier than that, but I couldn't really get hold of you. I couldn't
and
get you to
tell you about
give attention. He wanted to focus on my fight with Jacob Zuma. He saw from Sydney, being a South African who also was very steeped in all of our politics, and he wanted to focus on the fact that I just didn't give up when Zuma sued me twice.
But you didn't give up on creating a documentary, that's what I want you to tell me
about. I'm jumping ahead. He created the documentary, The Showerhead, and it has been screened quite a bit in Cape Town. At the moment, I don't know when it'll be screened again in Cape Town, hopefully next year, but it's going to be screened at an Australian Film Festival next year, and perhaps beyond that, maybe it'll get onto streaming services. We don't know yet.
Well, I happened to see it at the Labia, and I must say, you are laughing, but you're not laughing. But there were lots of angles to it, which I thought were very, very important. And hopefully it'll come back to the Labia one day soon.
I hope so.
Well, Ludi's got good taste, so I'm sure he'll want you back again. So all of this in mind and what's going on now, any good words of wisdom to sum up this talk about Zapero? Have I got good news for you?
Oh, I don't know about words of wisdom. I think you have to look at the cartoons for that. One thing that I would say about the title is that title jumped into my head fully formed very quickly. I never even thought about calling it I've Got News For You. And I suddenly realized only when it was going to print that Have I Got News For You is from that old BBC program. A satirical news program. So this is my version with news of something that I channeled without even realizing it. I'm always looking for things that I'm sort of channeling without realizing
and
it.
And as listeners to Fine Music Radio, you're always looking for good books to read. So guys, you want to have a good laugh at your expense, get a copy of Zapero, Have I Got Good News For You. It's cartoons from the Daily Maverick, and it's published by Jacala.
Thank you so much. We've come to the end of our show and the end of our year, and just before Christmas, and I wish all of our listeners the most wonderful, warm, safe, happy Christmas, festive season, holiday time, and most importantly, summer reading break if you get one. I hope you get to read something that you really enjoy, preferably something we've been able to recommend for you. That would make us super happy. Please do write into Fine Music Radio. Tell us what you're reading. We'd love to hear about it. You can also join me. I'm always on the Good Book Appreciation Society, which is a book club on Facebook that has about 23,000 members, and we're always talking about books. So if you want to chat a bit about books and what you're reading, or find even more recommendations than you've had on the show, you can find me there, and you can meet us there and tell us all about that. I want to thank Mzuma Keita for pulling the show together for us and being such a great guardian and custodian of this show throughout the year. I also want to thank my right hand, Vanessa Levenstein, who's a reviewer on this show, but she's also the unofficial producer of this show. I pretty much don't do anything without chatting to her first, and most of these ideas, if you hear a good idea on this show, chances are it was Vanessa's idea. Vanessa, thank you for your partnership through this year and through all our previous years. I love working with you. Big thank you to the whole Fine Music Radio team for hosting us on the show and giving us this incredible space. I feel so lucky and so hashtag blessed to be able to talk about books here. Thanks to our publishers who send us all these wonderful books and publish all these books. They're so brave in this market to bring out books. It's crazy. You know what they say? If you want to make a million, start with a billion and go into publishing. It's a tough, tough, tough business. So thank you for all you do. And of course, Exclusive Books, our biggest fans, our biggest supporters, we would be lost without you. Thank you so much. If you missed any part of the show, we load the show as a podcast on Fine Music Radio website, fmr.co.za, straight after the show. So you can go and download it and have a listen. And so you can figure out if you missed any of the books, if you forgot who the author was or the title, you can have a quick scan through that show and you can pick it straight back up again. What else is there left to say? We're going to play out with Take Five by Debbie. And I'm going to chat to you again in the new year. I'm going to be back with more books, more recommendations, more reviews, more interviews, bigger, better, more books, books and books and books. So until then, thank you so much and happy reading and be safe and happy.